On January 15, 2020, the United States of America and China signed a Phase 1 trade deal, and this is the latest development in the ongoing trade disputes between US and China. Exactly a year ago in January 2019, here on the Pragati podcast, we had established how what we are seeing between the US and China is an ongoing trade battle, but this is under the shadow of a much longer war for technological dominance. Manoj Kevalramani returns to the Pragati podcast today to tell us exactly how significant this trade deal is and how a lot remains uncertain. Manoj also shares a quick rundown of other significant developments in China in 2019. Welcome to the Pragati podcast, a weekly talk show on public policy, economics and international relations. I'm your host, Pavan Srinath. Manoj Kevalramani is our go-to China expert on the Pragati podcast and has been a guest on some of our most popular episodes till date. On episodes 66 and 67 on the Pragati podcast, he busts popular myths about China. And on episodes 77 and 78, Manoj and Anupam Manur talk about the US-China trade battles and the war for technology. And most recently, you can find Manoj helping us understand the 2018 and 2019 Hong Kong protests better in episode 112. Go check them all out. We'll start our episode on the US-China trade deal after a short break. Hi, I'm Pavan Srinath and welcome to the Pragati podcast. Hi, Manoj. Welcome back. It's great to have you here again.
Hi, good to be back.
So last year, last January, we had a couple of episodes with you and Anupam where we talked about the US-China sort of trade conflict that's happening right now. And what we really talked about was how this was an intense ongoing trade war, but the real issue was about technology and who controls technological IP over the next, you know, half century or so.
Yeah.
And we've seen that play out in various ways. And now it's been a full year since our conversation. And we are coming on the heels of an agreement between US and China where, you know, hopefully there's a cessation of hostilities and tariffs and counter tariffs and some progress. But is that really the case is what we want to talk about today. The other is it's 2020. China is always up to a lot of things. And as you know, your episodes on China are some of the most listened to on the Pragati podcast. There's an appetite to understand China in India. And I think there's not much that is very good for a lot of people. And on that count, Eye on China is definitely my weekly dose of all the madness that happens in China. So Manoj, first give us a breakdown of what is this agreement that they reached and where are we in this trade war saga?
Thanks Pavan for having me here and thanks for reading Eye on China. So this was an interesting sort of week that happened. Okay, so the Americans and the Chinese signed this so-called Phase 1 deal. And I mean, it's admittedly by them, this is a first of probably two or three phases of an agreement, which sort of seeks to rebalance the economic relationship between the US and China, and therefore also in some ways a strategic relationship, because the economy underpins everything for both sides. What was signed on January 15th was an interesting deal in terms of the fact that substantively there was very little in the agreement. It's a 96-page document which contains 7-8 chapters and a bunch of annexes, and each chapter deals with a different aspect of the trade dispute. The broad agreement is that we're going to right now sort of cease temporarily this exchange of hostilities, which was represented through increase in tariffs on both sides. And that's sort of broadly the agreement. Now, each of the chapters deals with different aspects. There is a chapter on IP, intellectual property. There's a chapter on technology transfer. There's a chapter on agricultural purchases. There's a chapter on overall trade relationship. And then there's a chapter on sort of how do you manage disputes going forward. The broad sort of baseline is this, right? The Chinese are going to buy more American products. These are going to be agricultural products, manufacturing goods, services, and energy products. The overall agreement number is the Chinese will be buying $200 billion worth of American goods and services over a period of 2 years.
So the current amount is how much? Like before of this happened?
So this is on a baseline of say 2017, sorry, which is about $185 billion or something like that. So it's a significant increase in certain cases. So for example, if you look at agricultural products, the Chinese bought about in 2013, 2014, they bought sort of the bulk of agricultural products that they had, which is about, at its highest, it was about $28 billion. And okay, right now it's going to be a little over $30-35 billion.
Okay.
So there is a significant increase in the commitments that they are making to buy. And that's the big deal. So that's the big deal that Trump is also pushing back at home, that, look, I've got the Chinese to buy more. And if you sort of see why that's important, you sort of go back to why this trade war started. And even before the first set of tariffs were levied, believe it or not, in 2018 January, on washing machines, and then it went to steel and aluminium in March, and then subsequently by May he announced tariffs on a certain number of goods, so sort of, you know, and then it went to the first set of tariffs in July 2018, and then subsequently things escalated. This was essentially about addressing the trade deficit.
Okay.
And so if you're going to be buying more American products, the idea is that you're going to be addressing the trade deficit. So if you will look at it from that sort of narrow perspective, what you will see is that in 2019, the U.S. trade deficit with China reduced. It fell below $300 billion, which Trump can sort of claim as a win, that, you know, my trade war has squeezed this, and therefore the trade deficit has fallen. And now the Chinese have sort of come to terms to agree to buy more American goods, which they were not doing because they were placing structural sort of non-tariff barriers. And now they're making these commitments publicly, so they'll buy more. So in that sense, it's a win. The reciprocation from the American side for greater Chinese purchases is that they will reduce tariffs on, and these are also tariffs additionally placed in these last 2 years. So they'll reduce tariffs on $120 billion worth of Chinese imports from 15% to 7.5%. So that's the only give that he's done. The other give perhaps is the fact that on December 15, 2019, an additional set of Chinese goods worth about $250 billion, if I'm correct, tariffs are supposed to be imposed on those. Those have been deferred. So those are not going into place. And this for $120 billion worth of goods, 7.5% tariffs have been reduced. Yet, a significant number of Chinese goods face extra tariffs. Those have not been given away. So goods worth about $250 billion continue to face tariffs at very high levels, and this $120 billion continues to face tariffs.
And these are very high levels, and they had either none or very few tariffs pre-2017.
Yeah, they had sort of. So these are specific tariffs which are placed. Otherwise, the rest of it fell into the normal U.S. regulatory policy, as opposed to, say, specifically increasing tariffs on something. Right. So this is broadly what's been agreed in terms of what can be claimed as tangibly agreed in this January 15th phase one deal. The other aspects of the deal, which is the IP, tech transfer, financial services, so on and so forth, is essentially aspirational. If you read through the chapters, what you will end up realizing is that they talk about commitments that the Chinese must fulfill. So it actually says that the Chinese side or the party, so each side is described as a party X, party Y. So the Chinese side is supposed to do certain things going forward.
Okay.
In some cases, there are deadlines. So, for example, I think it's in the case of IP protection, there is a deadline of about 60 days, if I'm correct. 60 or 30 days, I could be wrong on that, I can't recall correctly. But there's a deadline there where the Chinese need to produce an action plan of how they will do some of these things. And essentially, it's about how do you mold domestic regulation to ensure better IP protection. In some cases, there are suggestions of how domestic regulation should be shaped. So who should be defined as an operator in a certain case? Who has the liability in case an IP case has been brought against a company? So essentially, the company that's been charged with sort of violating IP needs to prove that it has not violated IP. And that is the kind of legal, the shifting of burden in terms of law. That's the way that this agreement suggests the law should be framed. So these are all things that the Chinese must do going forward.
Right.
How they do it, obviously, it's very difficult to tell a country that this is the kind of law that you must have and this is a time frame within you which you must have it, because the Chinese can very well step back and say, well, okay, yes, we've agreed to the fact that this is aspirational regulation. And yeah, even we want to have this sort of regulation going forward. We want to tighten our IP norms. As we become bigger creators of IP, we would like to have better protection, which makes complete and perfect sense. But you can't really tell us to do this in 60 days, right? There's a regulatory procedure over here. I need to, as much as you may call the Chinese a unitary one party or maybe even increasingly one man state, a dictatorial state, there is a system in place. You need to go through a process of consultation regulation. You need to deal with your private companies and your state enterprises who are producing these IPs, who are likely to go and produce more IPs in the future. And you need to talk to them about how regulation will impact them. So there has to be a consultative process, which happens in China.
Right. And even for much simpler things, right? I remember, I think one of the big American demands in India, say 5 years ago, was increase FDI and insurance.
Yeah.
And, of course, this was not in the shadow of a large trade war or a trade deal or something. But, you know, improving or increasing FDI share in insurance was agenda number 35 for any Indian government with all its priorities.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of American pressure for this one particular point.
Yeah.
And it takes its time. And even there are rules that, you know, DIPP or someone can pass. You don't need a law.
Yeah.
But it takes time, right? So, and here you're talking about a fundamental restructuring of the state-led Chinese economy with a few very special characteristics.
So that's what I'm going to say. And I'm going to get to that. This agreement actually does not do that. It does not deal with some of those fundamental issues. It does not deal with the nature of state intervention in the economy. It does not deal with, say, subsidization of companies. It does not deal with domestic sort of indigenization targets on high technology and all of that, which were essentially... So while I said that this all started 2 years ago with tariffs on washing machines and, you know, trade deficit being the primary thing, if you sort of roll back further, it all actually begins with the Section 301 investigation in the US, which talks about technology and IP theft and those sorts of things.
Right.
And that's the huge issue. And those issues obviously are not addressed because those are far more difficult. Those are fundamental to the Chinese economy. And to get the Chinese to give on that is extremely, extremely difficult. And I think this is therefore, in some ways, while, you know, the Americans might sort of, or the Trump might actually sell this as a win for him, you know, because he's got the Chinese to agree to buy more. The fact is that you've not addressed what was your fundamental concern. And that's what tells us that this conflict is going to go further. But sort of getting back to this idea
I want to take them one by one. Right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about the trade aspect, right? Goods trade especially. Hmm. The main commitment from China is we will buy more American products, especially more American agricultural products.
Yeah.
And that has a large political resonance back in the US as well, right? Because it's about farmers and, you know, whether they have market access in China.
Yeah.
And the US sort of return to that is, okay, we will slash the tariffs by a small amount on a select number of products that we are importing from China. So my first question is, even a country like China, how does it really go about just deciding that we'll just buy more pork?
Yeah.
One is to say, okay, if there were no tariffs, there was a certain level in the past. So we have a peg, right?
Yeah.
So X number of billions of dollars of pork, for example, were imported by China. So you can do some projection.
Hmm.
But then pork might be available from other sides. There is still a little bit of a tariff or more than a little. How do you ensure that you buy so much from this country in a world where you're supposed to have free-ish trade and market players?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sort of, in some ways, it's very strange because you are at one level, you want the Chinese to move towards a greater market economy system. At another level, you're essentially asking their government to further interfere in the market so that they incentivize companies to go and buy from the US. And that's what this agreement does, right? It creates a system where the Chinese will end up creating tariff exemptions for the goods that they want to buy. And they will be selective in that in terms of what are the goods that they want to buy. Say, for example, pork. There's a big domestic demand for these things. And there's a huge controversy specifically around pork. And pork is deeply political in China. It's sort of like onions in India. You're going to create incentive structures for companies to go and buy this, whether it's through tariff exemptions or whether it's through some sort of support systems. The other thing that you're going to do is you're going to be easing some of your non-tariff barriers. So things that used to get stuck at customs, things that used to get stuck because of quality issues, things that used to get stuck because of, say, concerns about health or manufacturing setups, those will get sort of easily pushed away.
So the stuff we hear about Indian mangoes in Europe all the time, those kinds of things, right?
Yeah.
So your safety checks, your quality checks, some relaxation.
There will be some relaxation. Or I mean, look, I'm not necessarily sure that there will be some relaxation in that sense, but what will essentially happen is that things which are not necessarily justified. So there might not be any issue with what you're importing, but you tend to create issues around them in order to create this sort of coercion. That coercion will be sort of pushed back a little bit, and you'd say, okay, look, you know, this is okay, let's just let it in. But you will be doing that selectively. I don't think this will necessarily happen across the board. You will do it selectively on certain products that you think your market needs. And so in that sense, when the Chinese say that, well, while we've agreed to this, this has to be based on market principles. To me, that's what they essentially mean. They don't mean that, you know, it's going to be a free economy and companies are going to be free to purchase. But what they essentially mean is that we're going to try and make it easier for our companies to go and buy these things. And it'll become a political priority to meet these targets.
So they'll nudge certain companies
exactly.
that they can nudge.
Yeah. And the fact that it becomes a political priority tells you a little bit about how it's going to impact, say, third markets like India, Brazil, and so on and so forth.
Right.
Because if there is only so much demand, and I have to import, 30, 40 billion worth of this, I'm probably going to prefer it from the US as opposed to, India or Brazil or anywhere else.
So it becomes, in a sense, some form of a preferential trade agreement,
yeah.
right?
Yes.
Our first port of call will be to buy from here and then we'll buy from elsewhere.
Yes.
Doesn't that, first of all, break other FTA and other agreements which will sort of notionally guarantee that, we'll be on the same playing field?
Yeah.
And
yeah, I mean, look, if you look at how the Europeans have reacted to this deal, they're frustrated because they see this as essentially a breakdown of what is this multilateral global trading order, or at least the first steps towards that breaking down. I mean, I don't think these concerns are new. These concerns have been there ever since Trump came to power. But this is the first sort of agreement which sort of shifts that burden from multilateral sort of rules of engagement to a more bilateral set of rules of engagement where you have more preferential agreements and it's okay to do that. And it's okay, and you don't consider the fact that this is going to have an impact on third economies. Look, countries can have preferential trade agreements, but when you start setting these targets, it creates a bigger issue. So it's okay for two countries to go on and say that we're going to reduce tariffs on 90% of the goods exchanged between us, goods sold between us. That's fine. But when you start saying that, well, I'm going to buy X billion from you, that completely distorts the market because whatever prices then are being set in the US are somewhere being agreed to as, okay, we need to bite the bullet and we need to pick up this. Whereas free trade, theory would tell you that if I'm buying pork at, say, $10 a kilogram from the US and I can get it from India at $7, I'd rather buy it from India. But in this case, you will not do that. So it's actually undermining the entire notion of free trade, the entire notion of comparative advantage and all of that. And I think that is where the rest of the world is sort of going to get, concerned about this. At the moment, the concern is political, largely coming from Europe. And it makes complete sense for it to come from Europe because Europe is China's biggest trading partner.
Okay.
So it's going to make complete sense to come from Europe. But I mean, Europe as the European Union as a whole.
And European Union also has its own crazy set of subsidies for agriculture and
Absolutely.
Animal husbandry, and
yeah.
it's a big export for them.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it's strange, right? How much ever high-tech we've reached, agriculture still is fundamental to each of these economies.
Especially the rich economies.
Exactly, especially the rich economies. And therefore, it's deeply political over there, just as it is probably in India. But in India, we don't necessarily, it doesn't get political in terms of how we are trading internationally. But, I can't, we need to liberalize our agriculture internationally, but that's another thing altogether. But yeah, but broadly, this is, so there is a political element to this because of the impact that it will have across the world. But I guess at the moment, most people are just happy with the fact that, the guns have stopped firing for the moment. And at least there is some sort of certainty. Although I don't think the certainty is going to last for long. And I'll get into why, because there's an entire dispute resolution mechanism that they've agreed to. And I don't think the certainty is going to last for long. So at the moment, the markets must be cheering, and they are cheering. But I think this is going to there's going to be a bumpy year in many ways.
Right.
I wanted to sort of talk a little bit about the other chapters.
I wanted to go through them one by one. And
yeah.
I want to see if my memory from our conversation from last year is broadly correct, right? So the second in the chapters, one of them would be about, IP
yeah.
and access. So if I'm not mistaken, the kind of IP issues are, one, if American company, there's IP and market access, and the two are sort of tied, right?
Yeah.
See how you want to unpack them. One is about American companies operating in China. while retaining their IP and not having, you know, Chinese firms and the Chinese state sort of stealing their IP.
Yeah.
The second is sort of China and Chinese companies buying American companies for IP.
Yeah.
Right. And some have been blocked. Some, there's some legislation in the US and perhaps even in Europe to counter that. Any other specific IP issues?
No. Essentially, they've divided this into two sections. So what you've just described essentially is discussed in the technology transfer section. So there, again, there is really no commitment per se. Essentially, what the Chinese have said in that agreement is that, or what the agreement asks them to do, is no longer subsidize acquisition of foreign technology firms with specific sort of targeting of foreign technology firms, which I would really love to see how you're going to unpack what's being subsidized, what's being targeted. It can be a legitimate business decision to acquire a leading startup in Germany or in France or wherever else in, say, robotics for a Chinese conglomerate, which right. sees it as something of value. How do you start to police some of these business deals? There is one way in which states have started to police these deals, and that is essentially through using national security as your reason for creating investment barriers, which has happened in the US, which is happening in Germany, which is happening in other parts of the world also.
Those are
barriers that you're placing, right? And you're saying that, well, you might not necessarily want acquisition of some of these firms. But how do you then allow regular business to go on in some way? Because would it be permissible for an American company to go and buy a German firm, as opposed to a Chinese company? And if there is a bidding war for a German startup, which has done something fascinating on, say, semiconductors or whatever else, is it not legitimate for a company to go and buy it? And if you start placing national security as your reasons to start blocking off all these deals, how difficult, so what does that do to the entire business and trading and economic system going forward? How does technology then develop further if you can't sort of co-work together? So that's one of the things. And the Americans have done this, right? Over the last couple of years, they've sort of rolled back a number of Chinese investments, even in a company like, say, Grindr. The Americans said that's a national security threat, that the Chinese have an investment in there, and they've tried to roll back that investment also.
In fact, I must say that the last season of Silicon Valley, I think, makes fun of this.
Yeah.
Saying that, I think, the equivalent of Grindr might also have army personnel on that.
Exactly. Yeah.
So if Chinese, entities have access to Grindr data of American army personnel, then there's a national security threat. So there are all kinds of bogeys.
Exactly.
That
so how do you
raised.
Sort of and how do you police this while letting cross-pollination of businesses and ideas continue? And as you clamp down on those, how does sort of, what is the impact that it has on business and further technology development? And does technology then develop in further silos? So you actually sort of create these different ecosystems in which technology develops, which can be equally dangerous.
And I think in Bangalore, we should understand it better than most other places, right?
Yeah.
There'll be, I know of so many people born in Bangalore, went to the US, studied there, incorporated a company there, incorporate a subsidiary company in Bangalore, come back and work there, and their client is in the US, right?
Yeah.
So this level of integration is happening everywhere.
Yeah.
And if you're going to put in barriers, that just ruins the insanely interconnected web that is, sort of modern economies today.
Yeah, and so that's the challenge. I would like to see how this agreement sort of allows you to police some of this stuff. It doesn't outline any steps of how it wants to. It just says the Chinese should not do some of these things. And good luck to them to make sure that the Chinese don't do some of these things.
You also mentioned tech transfer. So is it that current policy is sort of if a foreign company goes and starts working in China for the Chinese market, that sort of the locally incorporated firm gets the IP and then
so
that can go elsewhere?
It's not as black and white. What essentially happens, and it depends on sector to sector, but what really happens is that sort of the broad architecture was this, right? That when a company comes in, you essentially enter into a joint venture. When you enter into a joint venture, invariably there will be some technology transfer. The allegations are that, look, some of this stuff is actually written in agreements that you need to make sure that you transfer X kind of expertise and then essentially there is a diffusion of that particular technology and that sort of spawns other businesses and competitors and so on and so forth. The idea that you're forcing companies to enter into joint ventures with, at some level, tacit, if not acknowledged agreement saying that you must transfer technology, or at least the technology transfer gets forced as the company goes through bureaucratic processes, is what has been what they're trying to address here. And what they've again said in this agreement is that thou shalt not do this. I would love to see them enforce some of this stuff. And the Chinese are saying, look, fine. We don't. The Chinese have always said we don't do forced technology transfer. Companies see value in transferring technology locally. And I can see some merit in that argument also. So it's not necessarily that it's always that you're, that the moment you enter the Chinese market, your sort of arm is twisted and you're forced to. That happens. That happens quite frequently. But there's also a case to be made that, well, companies see value in getting systems and processes within that place, given that that's your manufacturing base, and technology gets diffused. So both of those things happen. But yes, on certain strategic cases, there is very clear evidence. And repeatedly, if you see what Western companies, not just American, but even European have said, and even the Japanese have said over the years, over decades, is that when you enter that market, the condition to access the market is that you need to transfer technology, you need to transfer know-how, you need to transfer processes. Part of that is organic, part of that is forced. Now, this agreement says that you must not do that. How? It doesn't define sectors. It doesn't say where and when and how. It just says you must not do that. And the Chinese are well and good to say, yeah, of course we won't do that, because we always say we don't do that. So in that sense, that's the bit that the agreement does. On IP, it identifies certain sectors. So say pharmaceuticals is one of them. And like I said, it shifts the burden. It asks for the burden to be shifted in terms of regulation on the accused. It outlines certain penalties. It sort of aspirationally, it says that, look, you need to be creating a system where there are criminal penalties on certain cases. And it sort of outlines a structural, sort of very loose structural thing of, you know, this is the kind of structure that we would like. Can you start forming regulation and laws which sort of enforces the structure?
You know, this is quite amazing because, first of all, there's a bilateral agreement forcing a country to change internal laws, yeah. Right? Which in itself is, well, it can only happen at the end of a war or a battle, and that's what's happening. The second is, usually when you look at these things, when the IMF or somebody else is leading it, or there's some, you know, package to rescue a country that's sort of flailing or failing in some way, all of them are about structural reforms, about, you know, factor markets, about, again, import-export restrictions and all of that. This is a whole new territory, right, where the deals are, okay, now how do you change your IP regime? I mean, yes, I mean, we had something that happened with, you know, World Trade Organization, GATT and other things. But this is completely new.
It's completely new. And it's funny, right? Because in May last year, in 2019 May, when these guys had apparently reached an agreement, which I presume is somewhat similar to what this agreement was. I think it was on April 30th, May 1st, when this agreement was sort of agreed upon. And then there was this massive kerfuffle with the Americans saying that, late on Friday night, we got a fax from China where with much of what had been agreed upon blanked out, saying, well, not this, not this, not this. And therefore, the Americans then pulled back, and then Trump went ahead and increased tariffs and subsequently also placed Huawei on the entity list of the Commerce Department. The Chinese obviously refuted, saying that, well, it was not that we pulled out of an agreement. It was just that there was a negotiation process, and we sent back saying, this is stuff that we don't agree to. The Americans said, well, they had actually agreed to it, and then they pulled out. That was the distinction that was made. And the other thing was that the Chinese, the chief negotiator, the vice premier Liu He, he went on this interview spree, essentially saying, look, what was being asked was for us to put our sovereignty on the line. You can't dictate to us how we should be doing things within our sort of sovereign domain. And we will never compromise with sovereignty and this and that. And essentially the argument was this: you can't tell us how to frame domestic laws, you know. Well, you've agreed to that now. Now, we don't know what the May agreement contained. It was what we do know, it was, at least from sort of the public reporting, it was a much longer document, about 150-odd pages as opposed to a 96-page document. So it probably went into a little bit more detail into some of these things, which the Chinese were probably uncomfortable with it. They would be happy with something which is slightly vague, ambiguous, which sort of doesn't necessarily put concrete measures in place saying that you must do this within this time frame, or which probably outlines details. They'd be happy with the vague stuff because these vague commitments are very difficult to measure over a period of time. And I presume that they would have even realized that, look, even if we commit to something, it doesn't necessarily mean that this stress and this competition with the US is going to cease. So we might as well leave it as vague while telling them the fact that, look, these are aspirational goals for us also. To be fair to the Chinese, over the last year, they fast-tracked that foreign investment law, which went through a consultative process from the American Chamber of Businesses in China. And from what I recall, the chiefs of the American Chamber over there were actually satisfied because they said, well, it went further than what we had assumed. And okay. In fact, the suggestions that we had given were incorporated in the final legislation. So they saw value in that engagement, and the Chinese saw value in that engagement also because they also want greater investment. And that's, I think, reflected in, I mean, the only sort of reciprocal bit of this agreement is chapters 4 and 5, which cover financial services and exchange rate. The exchange rate bit is not reciprocal because essentially it outlines, again, aspirational things for the Chinese to do, which is not to interfere, not to distort, leave it to market principles and so on and so forth. Which, to be honest, the Chinese have to a very large extent gotten to the point where it is largely market driven. Okay. Do they intervene in the currency markets? Of course they do. But is it far more market-driven than it has ever been? Yes. They keep sort of baselines for, you know...
But still far less so compared to even India, right?
Yeah. Predominantly, it's left to... you keep a, you know, daily limit of up and down, and it sort of regulates... sort of the volatility is contained. But predominantly, they've sort of stepped back. Because I don't think that's the biggest issue from them, from the domestic economic standpoint. So the exchange rate bit is sort of fairly, again, aspirational, saying that, well, you must not manipulate. And I don't think the Americans also see the Chinese necessarily as currency manipulators. Although in August last year, the US Treasury put them on the list of currency manipulators.
Okay.
To me, that was a pressure tactic because in January, just before this trade deal is signed, they removed them from the list of currency manipulators. I don't think the Chinese took any structural steps in the last 4 months to be off that list. So I don't think that... And even I remember when Trump was coming into power, he kept talking, and on sort of election trail, he kept talking about the fact that the Chinese are the biggest currency manipulators. And on day one, they're going to be on that list. It took him 2.5 years, into his presidency to actually put them on the list. So it's not necessarily the case that they actually, the Treasury actually, and Treasury, the US Treasury does a evaluation every 6 months.
Okay.
And at each point of time over the last 2.5 years, till August 2018, so nearly 3 years, to his presidency, for each sort of 6 months evaluation, the US Treasury did not find grounds to put them on that list.
Wow.
They put them on the list in August 2018 because that's when this tariff stress was escalating and you needed additional levers. And the fact that you removed them 3 months down the road tells you a little bit about how serious they were about this.
So this means that there is still some rules-based order in the US somewhere in spite of Trump.
Yeah. No, I agree. There is, and that's good. I mean, you know, you need, but this was essentially a strategic choice made by the government, which is saying that, look, we're in this contest and we need to use all our levers, and this is one of the levers that we'll use. On the financial services, like I said, that's one chapter which has some reciprocity because, and again, here the Chinese concessions that they've made are essentially about, there's a set of sectors that you've identified, so insurance, mutual funds and so on and so forth, funding and investment, so these sectors, banking. And you've said that we're going to be ensuring greater participation from American enterprises, which essentially means that the scope of what they can do will be expanded. Their ownership of companies in China would be expanded, or at least the sort of the market would be opened up for these guys to do more. And licenses that are being held up, say, for things like MasterCard and these guys, and, you know, those will be facilitated far quicker. In return, the Americans have also said that, yes, certain companies they've identified, and they said, yes, licenses will also be done more expeditiously. And this is reciprocal, that we both ease up these sectors for our guys.
So there can be Chinese investment into American banking as well.
Yeah, and the idea is that from the Chinese point of view, this is one of the commitments that over the last 3 years they have made publicly, not just specific to the Americans, of opening up their banking and insurance and financial sector broadly. In fact, their target to do so initially was 2021. It was to be done in a phased manner till 2021, which last year was brought forward to 2020 because they also wanted to do it quicker because they saw value in it. Again, One of the things that they are keen on doing is have, say, foreign credit ratings can come in China and they can work in China. So this deal opens up to American credit rating agencies. It's something that is valuable for the Chinese government also, given the problems of domestic debt, often which is hidden. It's not necessarily the case that Beijing enjoys, this massive debt buildup. It finds it deeply troubling. It's been trying to deal with this debt buildup over a period of number of years. In fact, Xi Jinping's crackdown on local government debt and zombie enterprises and so on and so forth. It's one of the three big risks that he wanted to address by 2020 is to cut down some of this stuff. Because you also realize that this is terrible for the health of your economy.
So this is the shadow banking, the whole thing.
Yes. I mean, and they've tried to cut down on this, and the outcome of that has been that private sector investment has fallen, because when you start to cut down on some of these things, where do your big banks go and where are your big banks investing? Well, the Chinese big banks are investing in state enterprises because, you know, those are safe bets. Private sector, because it finds difficult to get capital from state banks, it ends up going through all these other shadowy networks. So what's happened in this process of this debt crackdown is that you ended up hurting private sector growth in China. I know there are many people who might end up thinking that there is no private sector in China. There is a private sector in China, whatever the role that the government plays. And it's, if nothing else, it is evident from the shift of investment that the fact that private sector is facing a squeeze because it was ending up raising money from all these
places. The idea that there's a credit crunch in China is new.
No, exactly. Over the last 2 years, the private sector has really, really struggled. And part of it is structural economics, that, you know, where would a financial investment firm or a bank go and put its money? It will go and put its money. Yes, it's seeking for high returns, but it's also seeking for secure returns. And secure returns are going to be there from state enterprises, which are going to be subsidized, which are going to be supported by the government, as opposed to private enterprises, which can go bust and which are raising money because the cost of capital is expensive. They're going to sort of shadowy networks and raising money. So P2P lending and all of that. And over the last 2 years, for anybody who's followed the Chinese economy, P2P lending has been a big bust. And that's
with ripple effects even here. Right?
Exactly. So I think the Chinese are anyway moving forward to opening up their financial sector and actually doing it expeditiously. This deal tells them that you need to do that. And I think they're fine with that. I think there's one bit about where foreign entities can actually purchase or invest in local government bonds or, you know, things like that, pick up local government debt, which is fascinating to me. The Chinese would be thrilled with the fact that you can, you know, for an American firm to come and buy local government debt.
Isn't that great? I mean, offload the debt and make collection their problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's just brilliant. To me, that's just one of those things that, you know, I think the Chinese would have been happy to do that. But yeah, so broadly, the financial services bit is far more reciprocal than anything else. The last sort of important segment of this is this dispute resolution mechanism. So essentially, this is called the bilateral evaluation and dispute resolution arrangement. It entails, so at the highest level, it's got the U.S. trade representative, it's got the Treasury Secretary, and it's got an equivalent head from the Chinese side, which at the moment is Vice Premier Liu He. And while the U.S. guys might change over the next couple of years, I think Liu He will sort of remain largely in charge of things. So the idea is that these guys are going to meet once every 6 months to talk about whatever disputes that arise as part of their trading relationship. And then you're going to set up these other sort of offices in each side is going to set up these other offices, which will meet again periodically. And again, you'll talk about different sorts of levels of dispute. The idea is that you have these resolution mechanisms at different levels. And when a dispute is raised, it goes through from the lowest level. There's, I think, a 30-day or a 60-day period. There's a window. I can't recall the window. It's either 30 days or 60 days within which it must be addressed. If it isn't addressed, it goes up to the highest level, or you could push it up to the highest level. And it sort of goes up the chain, up the chain, up the chain, until it reaches these guys, the USTR and Treasury Secretary and Liu He. And then you try and address it. And even then, if you can't address it, there is another mechanism. It would be interesting to see how many things go up this chain, how these things are addressed, what sort of frictions are created in this, and what sort of action is permitted. From the American side, there was constantly this comment that well, we will retain the right to unilaterally impose more measures and sanctions in case, something egregious happens. I'm not necessarily sure that this agreement is that clear on that, but I mean, I'm going to read out the operative bit and I sort of leave it for people to make out whether they see that this gives the Americans carte blanche in case they feel that this has not been done. This is what it says. It says the complaining party may resort to taking action based on facts provided during the consultations, including suspending any obligation under this agreement or by adopting a remedial measure with the purpose of preventing the escalation of the situation and maintaining the normal bilateral trade relationship. So it's kind of strange. It's slightly open-ended. It's vague enough for the US to say that, yes, we can take any sorts of measures. And probably they can, because it says so. But the caveat that it puts is that, preventing the escalation of the situation and maintaining the normal bilateral trade relationship, that tells you that it has to be specific limited action. It right. can't necessarily disrupt things. So whether that specific limited action would entail, well, I can increase more tariffs, or whether that would entail, well, in this specific case, we are withdrawing or we are no longer doing this.
Right.
And it obviously gives the right to both sides. So it's not necessarily that the Americans, but I presume the Americans will use this far more frequently than the Chinese. So that's the one bit of this dispute resolution mechanism that needs to be looked at going forward. I mean, to me, this is... it's good that people are talking, but there's going to be lots more friction. This is not the end of the story. This is just a point where there's a readjustment that's happening.
So one sort of final question on this, and we'll take a break, and I want to spend a little bit of time on understanding what else has happened in China, because I think Xi Jinping has also been systematically consolidating power in that same period. And the question is, what in this trade deal tells you that it's sort of it'll help a business or a market environment flourish, right? Because clearly all that has taken a hit. Global trade has taken a hit over the last couple of years. Now, do you think businesses will be more comfortable operating either in the US or in China if they're from either country? What do you see that to be?
Look, if I was somebody who was trading, manufacturing or selling in these two markets, I would be very nervous. So at the moment, I would see that, let's just first look at the positive. At the moment, I would see that I can see that there is a modus vivendi that is emerging between these two sides, which is good. At least now I know that if I know that there is this mechanism and there are these aspirational goals for the next 6-8 months, I can see that my business cycle is probably better off as it was maybe about 6-8 months ago when I didn't know, whether tariffs are going to go up, whether things are going to be snapped, whether there'll be a new regulation where I can't sell something to the Chinese, or whether the Chinese will start blocking my goods at the ports. So that's another thing that at least that I know is not going to happen right now. If I'm working in some of these areas that have been identified by the deal, so in agriculture, there are annexures in the deal which identify a bunch of products, same thing in services and so on and so forth, I would probably see greater opportunities. So this is a good time to cut these deals. And given that the aspiration is 2 years and thereafter also we want to see an increase in trajectory, I would see greater opportunities. And but the concern would be what I just outlined in terms of the dispute resolution mechanism and things like that. What happens when some of these commitments are not met? Some of these structural commitments are not met. The Chinese might continue to purchase more goods over the next 2 years, so I still keep making money. But the possibility of some action happening on, say, things like tech transfer, IP rights and something like that, and that spilling over into the trading relationship further, remain very, very high. Because the first thing that the countries, that the US will particularly, and even the Chinese will go back to, is that the moment you start facing struggles on tech transfer and IP and so on and so forth, you start to clamp down on goods and you start to clamp down on trade. That's the lowest cost action that you can take.
And it's the easiest movable lever.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So you will end up doing something like that, which will create uncertainty. At the moment, I'd be happy that there is a modus vivendi emerging, but there will still be a lot of uncertainty. But probably if I was, I would be concerned, but as a business, I would think that I'm better off 6 months ago, so probably things are not bad.
More like trade, right? But
yeah.
In the investment climate remains extremely uncertain.
So, and I think the investment climate, I don't think this deal does much to sort of really soothe nerves on investment climate, particularly on things like, say, anything that has to do with technology production or IP production, because the US is continuing to strengthen restrictions on foreign investment in tech, in areas that it sees that it deems as critical to national security. And that list of what it deems as critical to national security is expanding. And that's the one area where investment from Chinese firms is going to be problematic. It's anyway dipped significantly, and it's going to continue to remain very low. American investment in China. Now, this is going to be tricky. For example, if you look at, while this time this trade war is happening, Tesla goes in, invests in this massive plant in Shanghai. And at the same time in January, while this is happening, Tesla's first sort of cars roll out of the Shanghai plant. That's going to continue to happen. Because for despite whatever sort of tariffs and whatever, until the Chinese see opportunities, they will keep their markets open. And they will say, yes, we would like you guys to come here. And that's what this foreign investment law is about. The risk for American firms would be essentially about, can I see changes in my government policy which restricts my sale of goods, even technology goods, or my investments in China? Because will that become then problematic? Because at the end of the day, if I'm producing over there, I'm probably selling it to, you know, Tesla cars being manufactured that are now being sold in China predominantly. But if I'm manufacturing something over there, so my iPhones, my other sort of tech products, and I'm selling them back to the US market, will that then see issues? So in that sense, my investments might get impacted depending on where my goods are going. But if I'm making cars which are being sold in China and the Chinese are, you know, liberalizing their investment laws, the Americans will continue to invest. So I don't think that will be a big issue. It's essentially about where your goods are going to end up. If your goods are going back to the US, it's probably going to be problematic if this sort of stress continues.
And here, one thing I've realized, even in looking at Indian history with FDI liberalization, right? The moment there was this time, I think around 14, 15, where every few months there'd be a few relaxations, something goes from 25 to 49%, 49 to 74 to 100. And actually, that creates more certainty, right? Yeah. Because say you've announced this saying, okay, I'll allow you 49%. And companies are like, okay, maybe in 3 months you're going to allow 75, which means that I can be the dominant partner with a local venture.
Yeah.
Why do I invest now?
Yeah.
Right? So while it's relaxation in investment policies are great, unless you do them well at one time, you create uncertainty for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And that's bad enough in a business cycle to mess things up. So thank you so much for this, Manoj. Just to add, so now with all of this, the morass of a trade conflict going on. In a bit, what do you think were the most important things that happened in China in 2019 with Xi Jinping, the party, with initiatives like BRI, and perhaps the India relationship? This is a big ask.
Okay.
Maybe I'll ask people to go read Eye on China for some of these things.
Yeah.
But maybe the highlights.
Okay. So what's happened in 2019? So this was an interesting year. Actually, 2019 was this year in many ways which sets up for 2020. Because 2020 is a politically significant year for the Chinese. It's the year where you're supposed to be meeting that broad goal of, creating a moderately prosperous society. Which essentially means that, you know, you double your GDP from 2010, which they're sort of going to do. You maintain high quality growth and those sorts of things. What's happened in 2019 politically in the country is that you've seen Xi Jinping manage to weather a lot of these storms. Not just with regard to the trading relationship with the US, but also with regard to, say, issues like the stress with Hong Kong. And he's managed to weather that storm. He's managed to get the party around him. The kind of internal pressures that we would have assumed that, you know, would have caused far more difficulties for him, he's sort of managed to tide that over. He's actually managed to come out far stronger. A lot of these external problems have allowed him to consolidate his authority to the point where, you know, the final sort of meeting which happened in December, the Politburo meeting, you know, the readout from that meeting officially hails him as sort of the people's leader and things like that, which is nomenclature reminiscent of the Maoist era. It's not the first time that that's been used, but the fact that that's been done. Also, that meeting, this constantly happens in Chinese Politburo meetings or sort of high-level meetings, is that you people present their work reports periodically, that this is what we've done and this is what our department has done. Usually the readouts would tell you that the party or the, you know, the Politburo, the Central Committee has taken note of so-and-so, or you presented it to the Central Committee. This time the report, sort of some of the reports suggested that, well, Xi Jinping sort of personally reviewed whatever. So the idea, I don't think structurally anything changed internally, but what happened is that when you start reporting in this format, you start to establish the fact that he is the central authority. You're reporting to him as opposed to the party.
And does this carry significant weight internally?
Yeah. So what
do the Chinese people in the media read this carefully as a sign that Xi Jinping is considered more important?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, I think that shift has happened, and I think that shift has only become far more apparent as time has gone on. And with the fact that it becomes more publicly reported by state and party media tells you a little bit about the internal struggle where he's sort of emerging as far more, you know, prominent. The other thing that's happened is that there was one important plenary session which happened, which again tells you a little bit about this, which happened in November. The readout from that session was also quite interesting because it essentially spoke about how the party's governance model will be strengthened. So what that tells you a little bit more, if you read out, go into that plenum data, what it will tell you is that if anybody had any illusions at the moment that the Chinese are looking at, you know, integrating into the so-called liberal international order, if anything like the liberal international order exists, it should be clear now that the Chinese are clearly saying, we have a different system. We are going to consolidate this governance system and we are going to push it externally also. We are going to be selling this system abroad also. That does not mean that they want every country to turn communist and have a single party system. But what they're saying is that there are merits in our system and we want to share these so-called merits with others. One example could be things like, say, you know, online supervision. Another example could be, and sadly from an Indian context, when you read comments about, you know, the need for de-radicalization camps and this and that, in many ways it's a very Chinese model, and they've tried to defend their model in Xinjiang with this. But the fact that these ideas become far more popular as effective ideas has a lot to do with how the Chinese want to sell them also. It's not like they're telling India that you need to create de-radicalization camps, but just the fact that when you see that this model has sustained and you see that this model has worked for this single party ruled sort of state, or at least the fact that they have been able to defend themselves against international criticism, for any government which wants to go down a similar route of sort of political control, they see it as something that they can, you know, do.
And the China envy operates at every level.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they have basically said in this last year that, look, we have confidence in our system and we're going to push this further. And that's the other thing, that they are clearly saying that this is a separate system and we're fine with this and that's what we want to consolidate further. In terms of the Chinese economy,
So they've crossed the $10,000 per person mark.
And that's essentially going to be the big story going out through this year. But GDP growth is down to a 29-year-old low.
6.1% or
so. But the fact is that if you, and as much as, you know, people may say, oh, look, there's trouble coming, GDP growth is slowing, they are growing. 29 years ago, the base was minuscule. Today, the base is $14 trillion. So when you're growing at that at 6%, 5%, even if you may be terribly skeptical about Chinese numbers, and there is good reason to be, even if you're growing at 4%, you're doing really well. The U.S. at about a $20 trillion GDP, or $21 trillion GDP, I presume that's the number if I'm correct, is growing at 2%.
Right.
So I don't
see. And that's the only sort of Western economy that's growing well.
That's growing that well. And yes, of course, at a per capita level, there's going to be a big difference because, you know, Chinese population is 1.4 billion, American population is, you know, 360, 370 million. So per capita, yes, they are making much more. So therefore, there's a huge power differential that exists. Yet the Chinese economy is growing as fast as I think is doing well. So despite these concerns that the economy is not doing well, it's actually doing fairly well. They are creating jobs. Officially, at least, like say last year, again, they said they created about 13 million jobs. A lot of these jobs are coming from new economic sectors. So things like the sharing economy is creating jobs in China. It's not necessarily the state that's absorbing a lot of this. But yet, what we've seen over the last year is that because the private sector started to face a crunch, the state has had to sort of take up some of these, tasks, and more state-owned enterprises are sort of trying to employ people. Yet a majority of the job creation is happening in the private sector. So I think there are some of these balances, and that will, to me, there are two challenges that are going to remain going forward. One is the debt issue in China. In the last year, one of the biggest stories was the collapse. They managed it, but the collapse of three to four banks. These are all local banks. It started with Baoshang Bank and it spread to a couple of others. Essentially, the idea was that these banks were leveraged with companies which were non-profitable. And the Chinese banking system operates in a system where, you know, there are lots of interbank guarantees which sustain the system. And the threat is that one collapse could lead to a contagion.
Right.
And Xi Jinping, in his last couple of years, when he outlined, in 2017, he outlined this agenda of there are three big risks that we need to tackle. One of them was financial risks. The other was poverty alleviation. And the third was pollution. And we need to do this by 2020. In this year, 2020, China will officially, formally say that we've eradicated absolute poverty. So we are a poverty-free country. That's a political target. It'll be met. In fact, funnily enough, I think last month there was a news report about Jiangsu province, which has a population of about 80 million, saying that officially there are 17 people who are poor in the province. That's brilliantly accurate data. I've never heard a government do that before. But you're going to see poverty officially eradicated. You're going to see them announce something that they've done on tackling pollution. I don't know enough about their steps on tackling pollution, but you're going to see them saying that we've met, because no, the government never comes out and says that we've not met our targets. And finally, on financial risks, they've actually done a fair amount. They've actually tried to sort of remold the market, but it's very difficult. This remolding has impacted the private sector. And it's evident from the fact that Xi Jinping had said that, you know, essentially implied, not said, that banks can fail. Yet when it came to some of these local banks failing, after sort of initially gauging what's happening, the government stepped in and they asked some of the bigger bankers and other institutions to sort of buy up debt and try to rescue some of these banks, because you saw the kind of problems that can happen. You know, these long queues outside the banks with depositors rushing to get their money out, the potential for, you know, this leading to other social and sort of security issues. And you saw the Chinese government essentially gradually trying to find a way where they can create the jeopardy to ensure that banks don't do sort of risky stuff, but also realizing that there's only so much jeopardy you can create without it having political implications, and therefore finding ways to intervene one way or the other. To me, that is going to be the fundamental challenge for the Chinese going forward. And that's why they want to have other banks come in and other stuff come in. But once the other guys also come in, it sort of remolds your banking system. So I think that's going to be the challenge, because that is your fundamental economic issue.
And it's a sort of middle income economy issue now, right? Which is coming into its sort of full blooming right now.
Yeah. So I think that's going to be the issue, which one of the things that I think everybody should be looking ahead towards, because I think that's the critical challenge. How do you manage that? Because a lot of the Chinese economy works on what the government essentially does to keep the economy going is manage money supply. And it's going to be critical to see how they manage money supply if these problems sort of further worsen, because you want to create jeopardy while, you know, so that there is discipline. But you don't want to go down a road where it can create political problems for the state. So I think that's the big economic issue. From a political standpoint, things like Hong Kong and what's happening in Hong Kong have occupied much of the attention. From a BRI point of view, the Chinese have sort of, there was a BRI forum this year. You ended up signing more deals. You ended up reorienting BRI after taking into account a lot of the criticism that's come in with regard to debt. There have been more than a few debt renegotiations that have taken place in Africa specifically. And the Chinese have reoriented some of their other investments. So in Myanmar, the port project, which was stated at some $7 billion, has been reoriented about $1.3 billion billion or something like that. So you've readjusted some of these things. You've taken a note of the fact that there's a lot of corruption that happens and you need to readjust. And you've tried to sort of repackage BRI and sell it as, you know, we're going to look at environment. Yes, we want it to be green and clean. We're going to look at debt. We're going to look at some of these things. From going from a position of what nonsense, nothing like debt trap exists or nothing like this debt burden exists, to acknowledging that, yes, okay, these are genuine concerns of countries, although we still officially say there's no debt trap diplomacy, but we realize that debt can become a problem for some people. And I think the Chinese have also realized that debt can become a problem for them, because it's not so straightforward that the country that loans the money has all the leverage. Because what do you do when the fellow that you've loaned the money to turns around and says, I don't have the money to pay you, and I'm not giving you a port? and I'm not giving you these strategic assets.
Yeah, the assets belong in their sovereign territory.
Exactly. So what do you do then? And what do you do when you, if you start gobbling up assets and then there is massive pushback and your grand plan sort of stops? So the amount of leverage that the Chinese would have in these negotiations is not necessarily straightforward. It's not straightforward that you lend money and you, in, you know, the other country becomes indebted and then you come over and take over their stuff. It's not that easy. We're not in the 1800s. So it's not that easy. And increasingly, there's more competition. The Japanese want to spend more money. The Americans have passed that Build Act where they wanted to, essentially, it's minuscule amounts compared to what the Chinese are spending, but at least you're suggesting that you want to compete. The Europeans have their own sort of connectivity project, which they announced earlier this year. So all of this, other people are sort of getting into the connectivity game with far more intent. It's not like they weren't there before. It's just that far more intent is now being shown and there is political muscle being put behind this. That creates wonderful opportunities for countries which have infrastructure deficits, but it also creates a sort of political push and pull. So I think, and that's going to continue. To me, BRI has reoriented itself. It'll still face the challenges that it faces, but it's on a better path than what it was, say, 2 years ago. Last year has been beneficial in some ways. Yet there are deep challenges. I mean, BRI is not, I don't see BRI as a grand strategic thing which is being manipulated by Xi Jinping sitting in Beijing. I see BRI as, yes, grand strategy, but also grand strategy which is being implemented with so many loose, unaffiliated actors which pursue their own agenda at different levels. That,
so it's become an international Sarkari infrastructure scheme, right? With all the problems.
Yeah, with all the problems. And also it's a case where, you know, like a lot of Chinese, you can tag many things as BRI. So a lot of Chinese companies that are doing, they're investing in other parts of the world. If you call it a BRI investment, you know, you get easier access to loans from the Chinese state banks, you know, because it's a lot of it is about reporting back. You know, what it might be is nothing to do with. I mean, the fact that you have a dance troupe visiting Pakistan or a Pakistani dance troupe visiting China and the funding for that comes through so-called BRI investment, it makes no sense. It is not an infrastructure thing. So BRI is many things. Infrastructure is like one component of it, although the predominant component of it, infrastructure and energy. I think that's going to continue because those are fundamentally a case of, I mean, you can see it as political grand strategy that the Chinese are deploying to try and reorient the world's markets leading towards Beijing and connectivity, all roads leading towards Beijing. But the issue is also a case of this is an imperative for them to outsource their overcapacity.
Right.
And they're doing that in some of these areas. It's all, does that lead to certain strategic gains? Yes. But does it mean that it was these visionary grand strategists in Beijing who thought up this and cooked up this plan and therefore are now sort of monitoring everything that... No, it's not necessarily that. So I can see sort of both those arguments. I sort of leaned a little bit towards, yes, there is of course political design, there is of course strategic intent, but it's not necessarily something which is being micromanaged to the degree that we imagine it to be.
Okay.
There's a lot of rent seeking that happens in many different areas and that's what's happening. But yeah, would it shift some of... Say, for example, BRI has shifted some of China's trading. China's trading with trade with BRI countries has expanded quite significantly. And every year it registers a significant amount of growth. If you think of it, that's after the 2008 crisis, 2008-2009 financial crisis, for the Chinese to realize that we need to be export-driven. And increasingly, these markets are going to be difficult in Europe and the US. And we need to focus our attention towards newer markets, whether it's East Asia, whether it's Africa, whether it's the Middle East. We need to sort of make sure that we pay greater attention to them. And again, Africa is a good place to pay attention to. That's what BRI has done in terms of the trading relationship. It's allowed them to expand because it gives the political direction to folks that, okay, we need to change our policies towards these areas. We need to incentivize business to work with them. And we need to do that. And that's allowed the trading relationship with these countries to grow. That's allowed the Chinese to invest more in Africa. Does that investment lead to diplomatic gains? Of course it does. But is the diplomatic gain driving the investment? That's why I say I don't see it necessarily as strategic.
Right.
So, yeah. So, I think that's broadly what's happened in the last year, although I'm sure there's much more that's happened.
Much more. And we didn't have time to get around to India in this, but that's... fine for this particular episode. Thank you so much, Manoj. Again, I strongly recommend people to start subscribing to Eye on China. And you also have a course coming out in February, right?
Yeah, so I teach this course, which is short 4 weeks. We do 6 sessions and we try and look at how... we're trying to sort of give you a broad 101 overview on how China functions, how the economy functions, how the political system is set up and how it functions, what are sort of national security, foreign policy priorities, how those policies are made. And we try and look at the technology ecosystem in China, which is, I think, significant from an Indian point of view, given the fact that over the last 3-4 years, there's been about $9 or $10 billion worth of investment that's come in from China and an increasing number of Chinese companies operate in India, Oppo, Vivo, so on and so forth. So I think we try and talk about how that innovation ecosystem in that country has evolved and how it functions. And yeah, so this course happens, the next edition of the course is February 17th. And I think admissions closed by early February. So yeah, there's still some time.
Yeah, and there'll be a link in the description. Who do you think should take this course?
So anybody who's... So the way we've designed it is that anybody who's either working with a Chinese company and is interested to understand how systems and processes operate, to somebody who's a journalist who's looking at China, to somebody who's a policymaker. We've had former diplomats take this course. We've had current serving diplomats at some points of time take this course. We've had folks in the armed forces take this course. And there's been greater interest from the Indian armed forces.
So you'll be covering the PLA and the
Army.
Yes,
so we talk about the PLA, the Chinese national security priorities. But I think it's also a case where folks from the armed forces are interested in understanding other levers, things like the economy and all of that. And we try and talk about each of those things. So each of these are scheduled as a separate webinar. There's readings provided. And there are fun multiple choice quizzes which you can engage in if that's something that you enjoy. We do a lot of those also. So yeah, so it's, like I said, it happens in on February 17th is when it begins and the first session begins. And we usually try to get one sort of a guest lecture if we can with somebody who's done something new in terms of China studies. So we'll try something this time also. But that's not, I'm not promising that. But yeah, but at least you'll deal with me for 6 sessions.
All right. Manoj, thank you so much for coming back to the Pragati podcast. Always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thank you to be here.
Thank you for staying with us till the end. If you have any questions or comments, do write in to podcast@thinkpragati.com. And hey, if you like the podcast and listen to us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review. It'll mean a lot to us. The Pragati podcast is available on the IVM podcast app and pretty much every other podcast app and platform. We are there everywhere.